This is Liquidity Talks, a live stream and podcast series designed to share the latest trends and updates from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk. Join us as we power up the liquidity conversation.
Hello, and welcome to our latest installment of Liquidity Talks live stream and podcast. I'm Neil Roberts, CEO and founder of Planex, the market-leading fintech focused on real-time treasury, liquidity, and risk. Now, our topic today is entitled Smarter Liquidity, Data Risk, and the Rise of Instant Payments. Welcome to our audience today. Good morning, afternoon, and evening, wherever you may be in the world. Anyone in the audience can ask a question as we run through. And if you ask a question, please put it in the comments section you see on the right-hand side of your screen. I can take these as we go, or if we have too many or we want to leave until the end, we can do that. We have about 30 minutes today. If you do ask a question, please let us know who you are and if you can possibly your role, so we have some context to answer it in. One other thing for our audience today is, just so you know, there are a few requests from previous audience members to be part of our podcasts, and we will get round to all of you. But if any of you would like to participate in the future as well, just email Nick Appleby or Adam Pemberton, whose emails are just about to appear in the comment section, and we'll be able to make that happen for us. Now, today, I'm joined by our guest speaker, Dave Wild. So welcome, Dave. Would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, my name's Dave Wild. I'm an industry specialist in payments. I've been in analytics and product management in various industries across the years. And today I think we're going to talk about liquidity and liquidity management, which I have significant experience over the past few years.
We are indeed. But as you know, if you've been on these podcasts before, we do like to just talk football at the start. Now, it is obviously my favourite talking point, but we won't talk for long. I happen to know that Dave is actually a part-time armchair sporting Man U fan. So look, Dave, after a decade of decline, having to survive the bottom of the league for quite some time and being completely out of Europe, you did manage to have your moment in the sun by flukily beating us a few weeks ago in the league. Normal order has been restored.
I'm just relishing the win against Liverpool. That's all I can say. Relishing and basking in the glory. That's all that matters for now.
As we dine off the top table with Real Madrid, obviously beat them. I just want to. Do you want to add anything in terms of the team you support and why? I think you're from Manchester, so you've got a bona fide reason.
My grandparents were born in Newton Heath, where Newton Heath Locomotive started, which was, you know, the predecessor to Man United. I got a long and deep history with Man United, so don't be just because I don't live in Manchester anymore doesn't mean I'm not from there and not
so when, a proper history, proper roots, then.
Proper history, proper background.
Well, that'll do for me. Right, let's move on and on to the topic today itself. Look, as a starter, it'd be really good to hear your views on, you know, how instant payments has evolved over, say, the past 20 years plus, and what we mean when we talk about this industry maturing.
Yeah, so instant payments has grown significantly and sporadically across the world in different ways. We've seen, you know, there's a huge lineage in sort of electronic payments, starting with batch systems more than 50 years ago in places like the UK. And they've evolved into things that were, you know, delayed batch settlements to instant payments. Now we've seen those instant payment systems, the maturity change in terms of who's on the system, who participates. So maturity is the function of sort of businesses, individual and or government who participate in those networks. So that's definitely a delineator. The second thing is really, which drives the adoption as well, is the mandatory nature of it. So two things can be there. It could be mandatory, i.e. government or business drives the adoption. And sometimes it's the only system in town. So therefore, you get a great concentration, a great variety of different businesses, individuals and government participate in those schemes. And thus, the maturity is really a function not of how long it's been running, but how many of those different entities are on the system using it and the volumes that they drive. So if you can imagine you have a system that could have been there for 10 years, but you only have individuals or businesses on there without government adoption or whatever, then obviously it's not at full maturity until you have a full breadth of players or entities in that network. And that volume grows in terms of the number of banks that participate, the number of businesses, individuals and government departments that use it. So it's a complex function of all those different things that drives the adoption, the volumes, and thus the maturity.
Yeah, and I was just thinking then, it's just my own experience of using what everyone just sees every day as payments, but these are growing exponentially, right? So you think how many payments you make per day, everything's done on a faster payment, whether it's transfer or payments at a shop or anywhere. So that growth, it feels like it's exponentially growing, not just in the UK, but everywhere in the world. Is that a fair statement?
It is, absolutely. And we've seen a particularly strong growth in Asia, in India, Philippines, across South America, and even in North America with, FedNow and TCH. And we've started to see as well the frequency with which those settlements happen as well. So in a instant payment delayed settlement system, for example, settlements happen at periods through the day. But we've also seen, and the greatest, I think, challenge when managing liquidity is instant payments and instant settlements, like we see in Australia and other kinds of places. So there's lots of different flavors of this, and they all drive different profiles as far as liquidity is concerned.
Got it. Now, I've got a question from Dan Feeney, which I will ask you in a few minutes, Dave, to just get the flow right here. But before I come to that, how instant payment schemes change in the dynamics of liquidity flows and volumes, if you look back over a few years, it must have an impact on liquidity and the flows, the volume, what you need to hold in schemes.
It certainly does. The two things, that the obvious thing is just the volume. So who's on the system, who's using it, how many entities or endpoints are there in that network? So if you take somewhere like the UK, for example, you've got a 68 million population, you've got most of government, most of individuals, most businesses using it. And then the function is then how big is that payload that they can carry? So what we've seen more recently is payload sizes increase. So in the beginning, you could only transfer a single transaction up to a particular level, maybe $100, 100 euros, 100 pounds, whatever. And then we saw that progressively increase over time. So 20,000, 50,000, and we've recently seen increases in payload size up to a million euros, a million pounds, etc. So obviously, that enables the outflow and inflow of liquidity across those systems, which is the function of how many people are transacting in that system, who are they, and how big are the payloads. And that has driven significant amounts of change in terms of the complexity of the liquidity flows and the number of players and the size of those transactions. So volumes are bigger, values are bigger, and liquidity shifts are growing and changing, evolving all the time.
And so if you're a bank, right, or a PSP, what are the key challenges that they face in adapting to this, real-time liquidity flow demands? It must put a lot of strain on them in terms of just where they put their cash and where they put liquidity.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. And these patterns and flows are evolving so quickly, and they get more and more complex. So if you take the SEPA instant payment region, TIPS RT1, that's been mandated back in October, now you've got 5,000-6,000 institutions now transacting between each other with bigger payloads in terms of the size of the transactions. It's immensely complicated, and it's immensely complex. You can imagine the patterns of interchange of payments between those different entities. It's perplexing, and these patterns and understanding what's going on in those flows is almost impossible to deduce from a single person or a team of people. These are the kinds of things now that can only be uncovered in terms of what are my flows now and where's that going in the future with things like AI and machine learning.
Got it. I'm going to cut in here with Dan's questions. So you've got two, actually. First questions: are banks and PSPs doing enough to prevent fraud from not checking beneficiary accounts using real-time rails? Interesting, because in the UK, I think it's not mandatory, but it's certainly a check that you always run through. But globally, I guess that's not true everywhere. So you think they're doing enough?
No, I think the standards in terms of the payloads and the way that the transactions happens and then metadata about those payments, whether it's checking and verifying who the accounts are, which they do in the UK, and there are various levels of whether that's mandatory or not. But until we have a better understanding of those transactions, and more particularly what they are, where they're going, and what they're for, which is certainly something that, that there's sort of a minimum viable payloads of metadata associated with payments at the moment in most systems, where the absolute minimum information passes across that network. A lot of the information about where it's coming from, what's it for, is not mandatory. So a lot of those transactions and those flows that go across that are not known. So that makes, by design, well, not by design, by consequence, makes it very difficult to track flows and understand what they are to counter things like crime. So when we talk a little bit later about metadata, we can highlight why it's necessary, not just to understand what's going on and manage liquidity, but more widely to counter fraud, money laundering, and all the other kinds of things that come with faster flows and more participants.
So if we talk about metadata, that must play a role in, you know, improving liquidity management, enriching the transactions, and play into quite a few things, I would guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back to that last point, the metadata that's generally captured today is the absolute minimum necessary to make the transaction. And that makes it very difficult. And the reasons for that are obvious, right? For regulatory reasons, information security, data privacy, all of those things. They've been the sort of the guiding principles for how we amass metadata for transactions. But what that really does mean is that there's not enough information about what the transaction is. There's no standardization. It's not mandatory, and it's very low quality. So a lot of the time, the trouble when you manage liquidity in a payments network is sometimes you don't know what classification of that is. Is it coming from a business or an individual? You know, what kind of transaction is it? What industry, for example, does it come from between entities? And, you know, other information is just what is it? So there's a huge need to enrich the metadata associated with payment systems, instant payment systems. And I think that will bring with it enormous benefits way beyond what we see in liquidity management. But once you understand transactions that are going through a nationwide or international system, you can start to use that data at the macro level, obfuscated and anonymized, to do amazing things with that real data. So macroeconomic indices, GDP, employment statistics, in a safe way. And I think with AI in the future, I think we'll be able to aggregate and enhance that data to the point where it can be used for public good. We can use for economic indicators by economists, by government, by businesses, and do a lot more with it than we do today. And that is largely grounded in the metadata. I think there needs to be a large-scale overhaul of, you know, what we can use this data for, and a sensible debate to understand how we can, you know, move from systems where we're grabbing data from lots of different places, using data that comes from surveys, and actually using the information in the payment system to provide real groundbreaking changes in the way we manage our economies and understand what's going on them. It sounds lofty and you know, reaching, but with some with investment, we can definitely reach that.
Yeah, look, it sounds like the payment data that you would hold, it's there for a purpose, but it can be used for so many other things. I think that's what you're bringing to life. So that is very interesting.
And then if we look at a system like Europe as well, and when we've got payment systems that are going cross-border, involving multiple governments, multiple transactions, just the utility is just tremendous, whether you're tracking tax payments or you're understanding what's going on at the macro level from economic indicators, it's just so untapped. There's just great potential there.
Got it. And I'll go on to Dan's second question. Just in the meantime, Steve Clemens, thanks for your comment on Dan's question. Dan asks, will the emergence of stablecoins linked to digital wallets affect bank liquidity on deposit? It's a question I would love to ask Ripple after their deal with G Treasury. But Dave, what's your view on the emergence of
I'm sure
ultimately how that's going to affect liquidity?
Yeah, you broke up a little bit there. Sorry, but I can hear you. I got the question. I think it has the ability to change the liquidity profiles, absolutely. But I think equally, the instant payment systems themselves, as they move international, cross-border, with the use of tokenization and other technologies, I think it has the ability to double impact those transactions and yeah. liquidity. So I think it's a very apt time to be thinking about stablecoin, tokenization, international payments. All of these things are going to have drastic impact on the flows, the transaction types, and they're going to affect not just the liquidity, but fraud and some of the other wider subjects that we just talked about. So I think they'll have a huge impact, and they're all interrelated and part of the same problem.
And if you think about AI for a minute in the context of this topic, but do you believe it's any longer optional for managing liquidity in real-time ecosystems, or it's now mandatory? It has to be part of what you either do or your roadmap, and it's got to be short-term too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not an option. It's absolutely mandatory to be able to use AI to have deeper understanding of what's going on in those network patterns. It's not something, as I mentioned earlier, that a team of people or even a person can understand in terms of the undertones, the seasonality, the periodicity, the different types of businesses and individuals that interact in these networks, trying to understand the patterns, the flows, and how it evolves now, but how we think it's going to evolve based on past historic information. I mean, just to be clear as well, we're not talking about like ChatGPT or general intelligence AI here. We're talking about models that can take past historic information and patterns, deduce those patterns, and predict future outcomes in terms of liquidity positions and other kinds of things. That is not possible with the kinds of complexities and the shifting patterns in these payment networks as new people come on board, as different business practices emerge. These payment patterns, they change. And having static type serve ways to analyze this data just isn't going to cut the mustard. So to be able to do prediction, trending, segmentation, and to be able to do predictive stuff like forecasting liquidity, the only way you're going to be able to achieve that is with AI and the kinds of technologies we just talked about.
Yeah, look, Dave, I think we put out a press release actually about a week ago around our AI journey, and we see a lot of what I call spray on AI, where it's AI for AI's sake. But I think what we're saying here is there's very specific use cases around forecasting, optimization, anomaly detection, fraud, all of those things that are very specific. We can use those payloads with AI to get valuable outcomes. It's not just about throwing AI at it. It's for proper business value here.
Absolutely not. And prediction, as to your point, is one of those use cases. Understanding and tagging and enriching that payment data is another use case. Yep. And there's a dozen more around fraud, which we mentioned before. Understanding, developing patterns in those in that data. It really is. There's a whole slew of different ways we can use graphing AI technology to understand what's going on in those systems and how it evolves. Because without that, particularly in systems that are less mature. So if you think about a system that's a payment system that's been running, say, less than a year, you have no past history to understand what's prevailed. So in mature systems, AI is going to be necessary for the predictive bit. In the ones that are less mature, understanding what those payments are and then being able to alert quickly to anomalies. So reacting, monitoring, and being able to alert is going to be important for other systems and participants at different cycles of that maturity scale. So AI is needed at every one of those, but there are numerous number of use cases for AI in this case.
No, sure. And Adam, thanks. Just put in the comment section a link to our press release, which is certainly worth a read. Thanks for that. So look, if you combine AI, if you've got a decent, back catalogue of data, probably running at least 18 months, 2 or 3 years. I know in the UK we go back, say, 20 years, but What's the art of the possible in what you can achieve, not just in terms of forecasting of liquidity in the payment systems, but also all those broader things you talked about in terms of GDP, economic indicators? What do you think is the, or what could the future be?
The future with changes to attitudes and be able to enrich the data in what's perceived to be a safe way. So ways that AI can transform that data, aggregate it, anonymize it, and make it available for individuals, for businesses, for government, for example, is transformative. If you take a system like the UK, I think it's been Faster Payments has been running for 17 years or so, most tax refunds, payments of benefits, government usage, individuals, most salaries, pretty much everything that goes through UK PLC travels through the payment systems in some shape or form. And having that data there that can be potentially aggregated, so you can understand things like, where council taxes are paid, where there's economic hotspots, where there's a an increase in benefit payments, whether you can look at employment statistics in real time and see shifts in employment in different industries, for example. All of that data potentially sits within these payment flows. But to my point earlier, much of that data is in its minimum viable state, in that it requires a couple of steps to enrich that data to the point where you can do GDP, where you can do economic statistics, employment, etc. The potential of this data is tremendous. And I think unlocking the metadata, unifying the data with the payment systems from other public sources to understand, what industries or what categorizations of payments or what the purpose of those payments are, is really going to unlock a tremendous amount of capabilities that's going to be good for business, it's going to be good for banks and individuals. But ultimately, you could end up transforming the way that the economy is managed through this digital interface using anonymized data for the public good. So I think the future looks really, really strong, providing we solve this issue of usage and anonymization.
I get it. Look, that's it's an incredible vision of what the future could be. You're really saying take the instant payment payload with a back catalog, say 2 or 3 years, apply meta data to that, enrich it, AI applied to that for forecasting other purposes, and you get economic indicators and much more in real time. And the example I think about, real-time employment stats. Normally, say in the UK, you have to wait 3 months plus to get them out. Now you can almost have that view in real time, what's really happening out there for, UK PLC, Europe Inc., US Inc., and in real time. That's incredibly valuable.
It certainly is, and it's real data. It's not surveys, it's not opinions, it's real
Exactly.
data.
It's a truth, it's a fact, and it's just happened. Interesting, interesting. All right. So look, your bank, right? How do you prioritize, how to unlock value and also reduce cost in this landscape that's kind of constantly evolving?
Yeah, and I think first of all, you've got to invest in consolidating the data. So having the data is number one. And I think the key to using it effectively in the future, beyond just liquidity as well, is that enrichment, that turning that data into something that can be used for other purposes. So enriching it, creating new metadata that can give you some of these other capabilities as well. So whether that's economic indicators I mentioned before, whether that's used for operational regulatory reporting to keep regulators and others happy, or whether that's using it for liquidity management, it's imperative, because what it does ultimately is it reduces the risk, and it gives you the opportunity to mitigate risk in multiple ways. So the risk of underfunding, the risk of reputational damage as a consequence of issues or interruptions to payments because there was insufficient funding. That whole compliance thing is a risk in itself. And that's interesting to the schemes, to the banks, to the central banks. That's of interest to everyone because we want the continuance of the systems to run 24/7, 365. And if you don't know how much provision you need and you run low on liquidity, that can be a serious problem. But ultimately, what we've also seen is that optimizing the level of liquidity you put aside So it's kind of the counter to the risk point. But what we've seen historically is we've seen massive overfunding as a consequence of regulatory rules. And that massive overfunding is very inefficient and costly for banks. And what you can do with a solution like this, like some of the solutions we've been looking at, is the ability to optimize funding levels, being able to justify those lower funding levels, those optimized funding levels, with the to show, you know, prudent liquidity management and justify the reasons why you can mitigate those levels or reduce those levels at some times, and other times when you need more liquidity. So you could, has a tremendous opportunity to have a better return on investment if you can unlock that liquidity when you don't need it, but have it there when it's absolutely necessary. And that's what we've seen in some of the work that we've done today.
Yeah, and look, I think a bank, you can't afford to have too little liquidity in the scheme for obvious reasons. You'd be on the front of the paper the next day. But banks tend to, what we've seen, overfund significantly for risk, but also it's growing so quickly, they don't know, they haven't got the insight, the visibility. And to your point, this, you know, one of the things that we believe they should do is you've got to have data access. The more real time, the better it is, but it's got to be, you know, cleansed, consistent in one place, you know, you be able to combine with other platforms as well. And if you have that as a start point, you can then go on to do the rest. Okay, so crystal ball time, Dave, right? What do you think the future looks like in this area? Love the vision you have of where you could head with this and the art of the possible, but what would, you know, some more generalized future things that you think we could head in this space?
Well, it's not getting any slower and it's not getting any less complex, so I can tell you that. Bigger, faster, bigger networks, more participants, cross-border, for example. We've seen in the emergence of the TIPS RT1 region, SEPA region, instant credit in Europe. You know, that's going to bring together 20-odd nations, transactions across those, instant. So you can imagine these networks are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So we're also seeing the emergence of cross-border as well. So we've seen, so I think that's going to have an impact on jurisdictional flows, compliance, regulation. When data moves not just across border but in different currencies as well, so that's going to be, it's going to be even bigger of a regulatory headache, not just the banks but for the regulators policing that, etc. But it's also a huge opportunity. I mean, it really does turbocharge business. We've seen different ways that that money can move around the across the world, and I think it's this grasping of the data itself and using it for the public good in an anonymized way is going to transform this huge, because basically the world is going this direction. It's not shrinking. Mm. It's getting bigger. It's getting more complex. The data is going to become more and more useful. We've got to grasp that, and we've got to circumvent the regulatory notion that we can't use that because it's too sacrosanct. I think we've got to aggregate it and obfuscate it and make it useful without mitigating or risking the data loss. And I think that can be done with the technologies that we've got today.
No, absolutely. Data creates insight, can ultimately create public good. So I totally get that. So look, Dave, final question. I always ask this for the viewers, if there's one takeaway you'd like to give for the viewers today, what would it be?
I don't like to use AI too much because I think it's way overused and a bit of a bubble. But with the use of machine learning, which we demonstrated in solutions and in concept, it really has the ability to transform this data set, the understanding of this data set, and the utility of it in a way that is probably unparalleled in the use of data in time. And I've been working in, you know, data and AI and data science for 20 odd years. But I think it's understanding the flows and the transactions. AI is going to have a huge role in that, and it can't be avoided. So I think adding to the metadata, understanding what that data is, can only be done by AI. this is not a function that can be done by people in an office anymore. So I think it's going to transform the way we process that data and what we use it for.
Perfect. And look, I think in the half an hour that we've had, Dave, we've probably literally just scratched the surface of this area. But unfortunately, we have run out of time. So look, thanks very much, Dave, for joining us today, sharing your views and putting up with my very unbiased football views. If anyone has any questions that they'd like to ask, even after the event, just send them through and we will get back to you with the answers. That concludes our latest Liquidity Talks live stream and podcast. We'll be putting the podcast on LinkedIn, Spotify, Apple Music, and other media outlets and streaming services very soon. Thank you very much for joining us today. Look out for our next podcast coming very soon. My name is Neville Roberts. Thank you for tuning in and goodbye.
Thanks, bye.
You've been listening to Liquidity Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on the latest developments and industry opinion from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk.